So, good morning again. Actually, good afternoon. It's afternoon. Here we have Drôme, Lisbon. An array of nationalities here. Probably, I don't know, maybe even six different nationalities. Wonderful. Wildflowers. I have my wildflower notebook. I also have my other notebook, which I'm kind of attached to these days, which comes from the Clooney Museum, which is the title. It's from a tapestry, which the title is Hommes sauvages et animaux fantastiques. And I love that. You know, so.
What's the first word?
Wild men and fantastic animals. And it so happens that the two notebooks have the five colors of the Buddha wisdoms, which we've been studying recently in our sangha. And that was pure accident. Have these because of that, but so in the organization of my mind, the two notebooks have different functions. One is the Dharma notebook, teaching notebook, and the other one is my writings notebook. So, and I just keep filling them up. Stacks of them. So, so today I was thinking two days ago I was in the Zendo at the Zen Center next to where I live, so in Montreuil at Dana, because I had heard that two of my longtime Dharma brothers were there and they were doing work in Zendo. So I came, went upstairs to see them, and they were building a kind of like a cabinet in the kind of back alcove of the Zendo, for you, those of you who know the place, to replace on the far end of the. You know, kind of think the front of the Zendo, there had been this shelf that had urns of ashes and pictures of the dead people who were in those urns. Right? It was all across. Well, it has become too small, that shelf, because so many people have died. Right? So they decided to, and Roshi had decided that it really wasn't appropriate to sit there all the time in the Zendo and look at those people there. That it's important to honor the dead, but that it wasn't, that wasn't appropriate for the constant practice to be that, right? And there was no room anymore on the shelf, so they took that shelf down and they're building a new one that has many more shelves. So I said, oh, but so the current urns and photos won't fill this whole cupboard that you're building. And I said, no, there will be place. And at this point, Roshi had come and was talking with us too. And they said, no, there will be place for more to join. And and we said, we kind of laughed, and we someone said, well, I put my name on the list to be put in there. And I said, well, you know, we're all already on the list. And then Roshi said, but who will be here to put us there? We don't know, right? We assume that we will be alive putting people there. And we kind of think, oh, we'll put ourselves on the list, and someone will be there to do it, but we will imagine ourselves being put our ashes there with a photo, a beautiful photo of us. We might even get to choose the photo. and I thought of, you know, the great artist Marcel Duchamp, who on his tomb in Rouen, which is like an obscure thing, why is Marcel Duchamp buried in Rouen, but it's because his family was from there. On his tomb he had written, "D'ailleurs, c'est toujours les autres qui meurent." So in English it would be, "Anyway, it's always the others who die." Because that's what we think, right? That the other people die. And it's like such a thing of Duchamp to put that on his tomb. He's dead and he's putting that on a tomb. Or, you know, as I was thinking about, I mentioned on Thursday, because Tuesday was Bloom's Day, Joyce in Ulysses, there's a quote which is, I think he has it, Blue, one of the main characters is going to a funeral, and so he has it written outside the cemetery where it says, "As you are now, so once we were." So you're entering the cemetery, you're alive. Those of us in the cemetery buried, we were like you once. But the question is, so what does that mean, as you are? And what does that mean, as we are now? All of this, you know, talk about dead, alive, are, you know, that's the verb be, being, and what does that mean? And what do we do with that then? Always when I think of these, you know, all these people who died, there's this great song from the poet Jim Carroll, "These Are People Who Died," and it's just this wild, like, kind of 80s punk thing, where he lists, he goes and tells the stories of all these people who he knew who died. And they were like junkies and wild people who like jumped off bridges, and his world in New York in the 80s, or in the 70s actually. And what does that mean? You know, he tells these stories of these people who died. And then we sing that and we rejoice with the song, something like that, you know. Or in the Nan Golden exhibit that I also mentioned, in the part of the her show about addiction, because she herself suffered from addiction to opioids, she has, you know, there's these voiceovers of people talking who were addicts, who were her friends actually. And so one guy's telling the story and he said, yeah, he had OD'd on opioids.
Overdosed,
yes. Mm-hmm. And woke up in the hospital or in a rehab place or something. And he was really furious with the people, the doctor who was standing there, you know. And the doctor said, well, you overdosed, so we saved your life. And the guy said, he was telling his story, he said, I just screamed back at him, yeah, but you ruined my high. I mean, isn't this like amazing, you know? Amazing. And there was also, in this same thing, there was this, you know, someone who works with addicts, I think it was Gabor Mate, actually, who said, in his interviews with addicts, you know, he would ask them, what is it about the high that you, you know, what are you seeking in this? And they said things like, release from suffering, ease, comfort with myself, love, connection, all of these like really human, absolutely natural things to want, you know. And this is so telling, that we seek something so pure and so natural and so basic in all these outrageous ways, you know. And basically, we're seeking to avoid death, to face death. So then it comes to the question of, okay, well, what is death? This ant is trying to find its way here, too. What is death and what is life? You know, what are we talking about? It's the addict, you know, that's really powerful. Yeah, but you fucking ruined my high, you know? It's like, you saved my life, but I wanted to be high. And then he also added, he said, you know, you go into a drug neighborhood and you OD and you don't expect somebody to save your life. You expect them to pick your pockets. You know, take everything that while you're passed out, take everything from you, but you don't expect them to save your life. So that's why you go to drug neighborhoods. So all of this, of course there's a koan for this, right? There's other koan. And this is kind of a mysterious koan, as koans tend to be. So I'll try to kind of simplify it and look at it maybe in a different way than we usually do. I don't remember the names of the two Chinese monks in it, so it doesn't really matter. We'll just say like Monk A and Monk B or something. So the two monks are going to pay their condolences to a house where someone has died. We don't know in the koan who it is who has died. And they get there, and Monk B taps or raps on the coffin and says to his comrade, Monk A, alive or dead? And the Monk A says, I won't say, I won't say. And the monk B is confused, you know, and says, tell me, you know, alive or dead? And the guy says, I can't say, I can't say. And they leave, and on the way home, same thing, and he says, I can't say, I can't say. Later, Monk A dies, and Monk B goes to some master and says, tells him the story, you know, and then says, alive or dead? And master says the same thing, I can't say, I can't say. And there's some other turn of phrase, and I can't remember what it is. But it doesn't really matter, because the master gives him the same answer, and of course, like at the end of all koans, he has some great moment of illumination. So usually we think of this koan, this is in one of our collections, the Blue Cliff Record, we usually think of this as being like, oh, this is about death, life, you know, the mysterious quality of death, so we can't say anything about it or something. And, you know, we plunge into this whole question of life and death and wonder why is he knocking on the coffin when he knows the guy is dead if he's in the coffin and all this. But what if we looked at it like, you know, if we come back to this question, as you are now, so we think, okay, I am alive, right? And the we, who was saying we once were, is dead. You know, these are big concepts we have of life and death. We say it's of extreme importance. We chant this every night after our sitting, right? Life, death, we have all these ideas about it, concepts, and we're so caught up by them, so trapped by them, that we're willing to, you know, kill ourselves with drugs in order to not face them, these very basic questions. But actually, you know, what if we, so if we listen to that, the monk saying, I can't say, I can't say. First he says, I can't say, I can't say, and then the guy begs him to tell him, and he says, I won't say, I won't say, something like that. Why can't he say it? What can't he say? You know? And why won't he? What can't he say, and why won't he say it? And what does it mean to say it? So we get into this thing with words again. In this book that I just read, that I've talked about too, by the Portuguese writer, the old woman who's telling the story says at some point when she battles every night with the night. The night comes and talks to her. And at some point, the night asks her a question of something, to give a word about something. And she said, how can you reduce it to a word? There are a limited number of words and an infinite number of phenomena. You know, we say the 10,000 things in our practice, but that's just a number that we put on what's limitless, okay? Limitless moments, infinite experience, limited number of words. You know, we create words as poets, we create words, we create expressions. You know, art is fabulous for this. And those expressions are also limitless. And yet, they are expressing the infinite. You know, art expresses the infinite through the finite. But if we just say, okay, so why can't I say if this person is dead or alive? Why can't I say that? And I think back to the other guy who I talked about on Thursday who died, Robert Thurman, who gives this example of an apple, which is a really good example. So he said, with our thinking mind, our discursive mind that can say things, we pick the apple. We don't want to eat a rotten apple, right? So we take an apple that looks good. We have preferences. We like certain apples. We like them tangy, or we like them tart, or we like certain, I can never remember the names of apples and what they are like, so, you know, there's like Fuji and Delinet, and I don't even know what these things are, but I can never remember which one is which, right? But we, so we name them. There was even a scene, forgive me for digressing, but there was even a scene from Stephen Colbert recently, where he's asked his question, he has this questionnaire that he asks people, and one of them is, what apple do you like? And so then there's this discussion that he has with Martha Stewart, of all people, about different kinds of apples and which ones they like and don't like, right? I was completely lost because I don't know anything about any of these apples. So, but that is what Robert Thurman's talking about when we use our discursive mind to know the apple and pick the apple. We wash it. We know that we should clean it or peel it because, you know, there might be stuff on it. We might want only an organic apple. We might want an apple freshly picked from the tree. All this stuff. We have all this stuff that goes on. However, at some point, we eat the apple. And that has nothing to do with anything that has come before. The experience of eating the apple, we may very quickly resort back to our concept. Oh, it's not tangy enough. Oh, this is really good, or something. But that's the discursive mind quickly coming back. But the direct experience of eating the apple, you can't say. It just is. And we can even have this experience of looking at the apple, and it just is. But that's something that we're not as familiar with, because we're familiar with eating. And, you know, so I can get this ant out of my cup, and that's my discursive mind saying, I don't want that ant in my cup, and then drink it, and that's completely different than anything I thought about this tea, anything I thought about the cup, Martinique, never been there, you know, think of Tiago's shirt with Grand Cayman, you know, like, all stuff that comes to our mind. But just that direct experience of the tea is not any of that. Not even tea, it's just this, right? Just this. So Thurman says, you know, he's not the only one who says it, but it's a like nice way of phrasing it. He said, the mind transcends itself. It's the same mind, okay? The same mind that can say and that does all this distinction and makes all these categories and concepts and all this stuff, that's the same mind that then is transcends itself and has this direct experience, or experiences directly whatever it is. It has a knowing that does not belong to the knowing of the discursive mind. Its knowing is not knowing, has to do with not knowing. And so when, you know, these monks are like hitting the coffin and saying, say it or don't say it, or I can't say it or I won't say it, monk A is really saying, I can't say it. Just this, right? Just what is this moment? What is right now? Anything else you say reduces it to a concept, reduces it to, you know, some idea. And the other, and really doesn't have anything to do with the person there in the coffin, actually. It's the monk A is responding to the, he understands where this question is coming from, of monk B, right? So, you know, sometimes we say, why do we want to say these things? Why do we want to these categories? Why do we want to put names on things and to hold on to them and know what they are? One aspect is it's useful, so we don't eat a rotten apple, right? And bite into a worm. Personally, I really don't want to see a worm in my apple, you know. However, as a child, I had quite a powerful experience once. My mother asked me to, she had bought like some corn at the farmer's market. And so she asked me to take it outside, and I think I wanted to do it too. Take it outside and, you know, what we call husk it. So you take off the, the husks of it, right? So I'm doing this casually, you know, and did one, did another one, get to the moment. And suddenly, when I did it, there was this like fluorescent green and orange and yellow, huge worm caterpillar thing. I was just like, Dale seems to know what I'm talking about. It was like everything stopped. My entire mind stopped at that moment. This, I can still see that fluorescent thing on that yellow corn cob. Very quickly, the discursive mind took over, even in the child's mind, it's the same, took over and was like, ah, you know, I threw it down and ran in the house and I'm not going to do that anymore, you know. And almost every time that I pick up a husk of corn, I think of his parents. And this was, you know, like 60 years ago. But there was that second of everything stopped. You know, everything just stopped. The, you know, we say, okay, the mind transcends itself. We also say the discursive mind stops, you know, the flow of all this stuff stops. And it wasn't even, you know, even now, I don't know if you call it a worm or a caterpillar in corn. I don't know, probably a caterpillar, right? Is it? Because it'd be, I don't know, whatever. But even that, you know, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. It's just something that I was not expecting as a child, of course. Had no idea about it. I was completely in not knowing, actually, because I was just peeling the stuff off, and then suddenly, wah, and I experienced it from a place of not knowing, and then very quickly, terror, fear, run away, flee, get rid of it, don't want to ever see a corn husk again. So what resists that? So when we talk about this not knowing, this direct experience, sometimes we put this word on it in the Buddhist jargon of emptiness, which means that it is empty of the concepts, of all the stuff that we've put on it. It's just, it's pure essence or something. Which doesn't mean it's dirty when it's got all the stuff on it, but it's just not the same, right? It's the same essence, but we've put a lot of stuff on it. So I experience directly the caterpillar on the corn, not even thinking caterpillar or corn. I experience directly the tea, not thinking anything about what tea, who made it, where it came from, where the cup came from, how it tastes. That's just direct experience. And so we call that emptiness, that what we're experiencing is emptiness. And in our Western jargon, we say the ego resists emptiness. Or we could say this idea of self that we have, who we identify with, resists that emptiness because it's afraid of being free. It's afraid of freedom. And this is the same reflex of the addict that wants to hang on to the high because that's when they feel free. And don't realize that the true freedom is not that at all. That the true freedom is to experience the basic reality, the true nature of things, without all the stuff we add onto it, and without our attachments and our ideas and our positions and beliefs, what we like and what we don't like, separating me from you, and you know, I talk with a Polish friend of mine a lot, and you know, she has a completely different perspective. She doesn't like the Russians. The Poles hate the Russians. But she thinks Zelensky's horrible, he's corrupt, he should be gone, the Ukrainians hate him. Right, so this is like a completely different perspective, what I tend to see here, right? Okay, she has her position, she has her, you know, beliefs, all that stuff, but the absolute reality, and that's just a, you know, one example of how we fix positions and beliefs and ideas, and we see where it takes us. It takes us, you know, to wars, bombing, killing, rejecting, addiction, shutting people out, shutting down ourselves. And as Robert Thurman said, a yogi is someone who rebels against suffering. Which is really nice, you know. And the suffering is this clinging. You know, this is like clinging to our ideas and the way we want things to be, particularly the way clinging to this, to I, this I that we've created. I doubt that this ant coming around here is clinging to I. Right? We don't know, but as far as we do know, our discursive mind and all of our intellect has taught us or has led us to study animals and other beings, and we found that we have this possibility, our mind, to transcend itself, whereas other, you know, wild animals don't seem to, right? But this is our deepest problem as well. This is our deepest suffering. We are clinging to this, to I. And trying to keep things contained, trying to put order in the chaos, which is the natural order of everything, right? Chaos. It's the order of disorder, you know, or the disorder of order, or something like that. And we don't want that because we're afraid of it, because we don't say to ourselves we will be free. We say to ourselves that we won't exist anymore, and we want to exist. So this I is clinging to its existence. You know, like we say in French, bec et ongles, you know, with its mouth and its fingers, it's hanging on to its existence because it's afraid of it thinks that if it let go, it lets go, it won't exist. And one of the questions that the Buddha didn't answer ever was, exist, not exist. Any questions like that of duality, he remained silent. It's just like this guy, the monk A, saying, I can't say. He could have just remained silent. It would have been the same thing, right? Because as soon as you say one, well, then you set up the other. So if you say, yes, you exist, well, then there's also the possibility of not existing. And this is what our discursive mind, our attached mind to self, is thinking. That if I lets go, I will no longer exist. Because it thinks it exists. So if it doesn't, if it isn't existing, then it must be not existing. But the whole thing is like upside down. Or as the Buddha said, you know, it's turn around completely, because it's not that at all. So he remains silent, the Buddha. As this text we're studying in the study group says, you have to say something, right? That's the position we're in at the moment. But you can say, I can't say. I won't say. Or at some point, when you truly see the apple, and I have this poem about it, which I wish I had been able to find before, about seeing an apple. When you truly see the apple, then you can say apple. And it's not the same thing as the apple before. You know, the famous quote that Dogen says about mountains and rivers. First, it's mountains and rivers, apples and oranges, me and you, all that. Then, after you've somehow managed to have a glimpse that pulls the rug out from under all of that, there's no apples, there's no oranges, there's no mountains, there's no rivers, I can't say. No differences, everything is one, just what it is. And then the real steep slope is to come to the next phase, which is mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers. And apples are apples and oranges are oranges. It's not the same as before you went up that slope. Or maybe it's you went down the slope and then you go back up. Or it's when you went up the slope and then you go back down. I don't know. So the mountains and rivers are just us. It's just you, actually. So what does that mean? You know, I am me, I know my story, you know, I'm sick of my story, and I'm sick of myself, and I don't want to be like this, or I love myself, and I want to be like this, and I want everyone to see that I'm like this, or I don't want anyone to see that I'm like this. You know, part of the power of this workshop that we've been doing with the five Buddha families is that we discover stuff about ourselves that we had no idea about. And we discover stuff about the others, too, which is really incredible. You know, these are people we know and practice with a lot. Really interesting, you know? But that's just a way of helping us to loosen our grip on who we think we are. It's another grid that helps us to loosen, so that we're not trapped like those astronauts in that tiny space vessel in vast space. Not trapped by this regime of ego. You know? And, you know, as Robert Thurman pointed out, I don't know if I said this on Thursday, but, you know, he said the Buddha was a great doctor. He treated the human condition and our situation as a doctor would. You know, he said there's this symptom that we all have, we're all showing, it's this suffering, this discomfort, this unease, this feeling trapped, this feeling not free. And then all of us, you know, deal with that symptom in different ways. The guy who ODs on, who overdoses on opioids, he's dealing with that symptom in a way, in one way. Somebody else deals with it in a different way. And it can be very subtle how we deal with that symptom. as it can be with, you know, we have all, you know, I have seasonal allergies, so how do I deal with those symptoms? I tend to do it, you know, with alternative acupuncture or stuff like that. Somebody else just takes Zyrtec, you know, just takes the drug to ease the symptoms. Everybody deals with their stuff differently. So then the Buddha points out that, okay, he sees this symptom, and then he gives this, what is this symptom a symptom of? You know, what is this, what's the problem here? What's the cause of that? And he points out that the cause of this unease, this discomfort, this displeasure, all the stuff we do by hurting each other and everything, what's the cause of that? So it's like, you know, okay, you have the symptom, so okay, I'm sneezing a lot. Oh, that's a symptom of an allergy, right? That's a symptom of this not seeing the true nature of things, not seeing who you truly are, not seeing the emptiness, not seeing the basic essence, the oneness of all things. And then he gives this, you know, so he like writes out the, he said, okay, there's a prognosis, it can be healed, you can be cured of this, and you go to the doctor and you're happy when the doctor said, okay, yeah, good, I can be cured. You know, you go to the dentist, you might say, well, I can take care of that, but I have to pull out the tooth. Or, yeah, we can take care of that, but change your, I don't know, floss or something. The Buddha, as a good doctor, said, okay, the prognosis is good. You can be cured. And then he writes out the prescription and said, this is what you do. And he gives this eightfold path of how to put an end to it. You know, brilliant doctor, right? He didn't realize anything that other people hadn't realized, but he did have a different approach to it and a different pedagogy and a different way of presenting it that spoke to his time, but is still speaking to us today, for better or worse, you know. I say worse because we're still doing the same dumb stuff, but the prescription and the diagnosis is still there. And as Thurman also pointed out, one of the other great things from the Buddha was that the word dharma, which we talk about all the time, so I'm giving a dharma talk, my dharma brother, dharma this, dharma that. Well, this is, you know, a really ordinary word in India, apparently, in Sanskrit, which just means law. And so Thurman says this, I don't know this for myself, but even, you know, people go to university and they study dharma, they're studying law in India. I don't know if today they still do call it that, but it's time they did. And so he, like the Buddha, redefined this term, dharma, which was quite radical at his time, but he was completely radical, and our practice is still just like undeniably radical, what we're doing here. So he, you know, basically he said, you can't achieve freedom, this freedom we're talking about, through laws. You can't, through the rules, through the directions, through the guidebooks, through the maps, through the orders, you can't become free through that. You can't do it. You can only achieve it through understanding reality. And I think Thurman said understanding, but, you know, I would say experiencing reality. Because even understanding, our discursive mind takes that on as, oh, I'm going to intellectually understand it. But that's not what he's talking about. He's talking about experiential understanding. Of course, all the stuff, you know, we just gave this four-point, you know, this PowerPoint from the Buddha, right? You know, that was like the first PowerPoint, or something like that. So we just gave that, and that helps. That's a map. That's a prescription from the doctor, right? It can help us to understand intellectually, and to, you know, we can go into where this tea came from, who grew it, who bought it. We can even like appreciate the sun and the rain and Debbie who brought it, and I don't know who boiled the water and where it came from and all this. You know, we can have all of that stuff. And that's wonderful. But to truly experientially understand the tea, we have to drink it. That's it. And this, so to become free from our suffering, which, you know, that's just another term for nirvana, is what we say. Our mind has to transcend itself and let go of the ideas and experience directly that I can't say, I can't say. So that, you know, that koan is actually about life. So it's when we say, so if we go back to Joyce's quote, as you are now. So who are we now? Who am I now? You know? What is that? That's what this poem is about. You know, it's not about the dead guy in the coffin. It's like, now, alive, who am I? What is this? What is this moment? And it's every moment. It's ongoing. You know, it's like we can't... So just this morning, if we look, so when we sat down, there was a certain pattern of sunlight and shadow on the floor. When we came back after tea, it was a completely different one. And the ants that were moving around in the sunlight, in and out of the sunlight and shadow here in front of me, they weren't there anymore. Different moment, different manifestation. If I'm hanging on to, I want the sun to shadow to be back like it was, well, I'm going to be missing how it is now. And I'm going to be suffering. Right, because I would be not satisfied because it's not how I want it to be. You know, even so, here we were talking this week. Oh, it's going to be really hot on Saturday. What are we going to do? Very nice. You know, the woman, she lets us use her fan, and we have this. You know. And yet, it's nothing like we thought it would be. Of course, maybe. I was not too worried about it, and I don't like the heat, but I really wasn't too worried about it. But even me, that is not at all. This experience of being here now is not at all what I could have thought about it before. Or another one, so we had this whole issue about our summer retreat, which, you know. So the place where we're going, made a mistake with the booking and booked another group for four of the days when we're going to be there. And there's room for all of us. It will be tight. It so happens that the other group is 40 teenagers at a holiday camp.
You're really selling it now. What? You're really selling it now. Yeah.
And we will be, you know, like, I don't know, 25 adults on a meditation retreat. Silent meditation retreat, right? So they keep saying, well, the other group will be at the beach all day. The beach is really close, you know, we can see it from our zendo, we can see it. We even go at night and sit at the beach for our sitting. But so they'll be at the beach all day. They'll use a different kitchen. We'll try to put them all in the dormitories, but I have this bad feeling that the dormitories are near the room that I'm going to be in. So we'll tell them to be silent. We'll tell them to be silent. You can talk to them and tell them to be silent. Right? So all of this is like, you know, okay. On top of that, the prices have gone up, and, you know, it's all this stuff. So, you know. As I said to Tiago yesterday, well, we'll do what we can do with it, you know. And we don't have a choice. Our choice is not to go, but we can't do that, right? We don't have anywhere else to go. And actually, I feel like, and I said this to Tiago, I feel like the challenge of the other group is much steeper than our challenge. Those people who are organizing, you know, I don't know if it's a scout group or what they are, but they're leaders of that group. It's a bigger challenge for them to, you know, herd 40 teenagers and keep them silent so that the meditation retreat is not disturbed. Then we don't have any problem keeping silent. and we are we train, we practice to just embrace things as they are and include whatever it is, right? Of course, we would like to be able to sleep at night. And not, you know, have too much, I won't even say disruption, but whatever it is, it will not be what we're used to having. Our ideas about a meditation retreat, gone. This is very much a real practice of what it is to be alive, here and now. We just never know what's coming. At least they warned us, you know. They only warned us, what, a few weeks ago, right? But, A week ago, yeah. Apparently, they just realized it, but I find that hard to believe, but okay. Who knows, you know. So at least they gave us some warning, you know. And not that we can prepare, but it's just our, this is our life. You know, this is our practice. I don't think that those 40 teenagers and their leaders have that practice, you know. Maybe they do a meditation retreat too, but I don't think so. Because apparently they're going to the beach all day. It's like surf camp or something.
What if it rains the whole
way? Well, then we'll deal with that too. You know?
Are they there the whole week?
No, 4 days. They arrive on Wednesday.
Three nights.
So, just you know, this is a great practice opportunity, an opportunity to be completely in life, and I won't say. You know?
I spent 35 years with 40 teenagers. I don't need this.
Right. Of course, it was a different context, and you had a different relationship with them.
It would be very interesting.
It's true, you know. And this will require us to, it's a plunge, you know, as Bernie Glassman so astutely presented it, you know, it's a plunge into this situation, and we go into it with not knowing. We let go of our ideas about it, and bear witness to it, and then respond accordingly. We might have to, like, you know, I'm going to talk to Tiago after this retreat to look at some things we can do with, but this is our life, you know, and this is what it is to, like, knock on the coffin and say, I can't say. There's no escape, right? So, you know, we could say, okay, well, we're not going to go to that place. We'll find somewhere else to sit for that week. Okay, we'll go there. But then it will be a different circumstance wherever we go. Wherever you go, here you are, right? Here we are, wherever you are. There's no escape. And the point is not to escape. This point is to be truly one, here, now, with what is. That's the freedom. And the no escape part is the good news and the bad news. The bad news is you can't get away from it. The good news is you don't have to. There's nowhere to go. You're already there, you know? So, maybe I'll stop talking there, and if anyone wants to share something, contribute, you guys on the screen too, if you want to share questions. thank you. To start out with, for this talk. And it's funny that you, interesting that you brought that topic, that subject of life and death and knocking on the coffin. Because I've been looking at, as a lot of us probably are, my mother is aging, and I've been, there's this issue with my brother, and so I've been looking with, I've been sitting a lot with, the life and death, and what is it? What is it for my mother to not be here when she will go? And what is it for my brother to, what happens for my brother, who's, for those who don't know, who's handicapped, let's say. And I was telling someone recently, it's, I sit with it like a koan, not knowing. And that really changes my perspective on, just what's going to happen. Well, I don't know. I don't know, and that's just what it is. And it's sort of, I feel when I do that, the release of the clinging to my mother being alive and clinging to the situation as it is now, and just not knowing what will happen to any of us, because, what I am envisaging might not happen anyway, probably won't happen. And so, it doesn't mean that I don't have to, I shouldn't think about it, because I need to prepare stuff to organize some things, but I have no idea how, what will happen when it happens. So, it's just like, sit with the not knowing of life and death, and our own and all those around us, and close or not close. I can't say, really, I can't say. Doesn't mean that it's not frightening, or, sometimes a bit, whatever emotion comes up with it, but it's a great practice anyway, or it's just just what you were saying. So thank you.
Absolutely.
There is this release, this peace of not knowing. Even, so we come in here and we sit down. And in the first meditation period, I was just feeling this such great joy to be here, and that each of you is here, and that there was like nowhere else I would rather be than right now, than right here, right now. And this is something I'm familiar with walking into a sitting place and sitting down, and I'm familiar with that feeling. And yet, I know it comes from the dropping of ideas about how it should be, what the room should look like, who should get, I was late, clinging on to, oh, you're so bad because you were late, and then it meant the people couldn't connect online, and, entering into, I just think that was dropped. I just dropped it. And then this just joy could arise. Like you say, it's just, it's a, all of that kind of clinging and the tightness that's there otherwise drops away.
And comes back.
It comes back, of course, yeah. What was this thing that I wrote here about? This woman wrote, this writer. Where did she write this? I guess it wasn't in this book. Maybe it was in the other one. She said, this writer, Anne Lamott, said, maybe it was in this book. I'm confused now. I actually know what it is, but I should, I wrote somewhere else. She said, someone was asking her about, you know, writing, and I will write at another moment, I'll write when I retire, I'll write when, as we know about writing, Nina and I, I'll write when I'm on vacation, or I'll write next week, or something. And she said, just write, because it's not about, what should I say, it's not about making more effort. It's about resisting less. It's like wood on your rock or so too, you know. It's about resisting less. And that's what we do. We resist so much of just what is, and we make this big effort. We're making all this effort to make it something else, to think about it, to project, to cling to the past, to have this project for how we want it to be, and, you know, planning, and then being afraid of how it's going to be or not be, and all this stuff, when all we need to do is just not resist, and then it's okay. I mean, maybe it's not perfect, like we said. Yes, it is. It's perfect, the perfect way. However, it's a completely different experience. And it's whatever we do. It's not like just because you're a writer or because, you know, you have a thing you're worried about your mother and your brother. You know, it's all the time. All the time, all the time, all the time. Yes, Nina.
This thing you're saying about direct experience, really find it very interesting, because I have experienced it in the way of art, let's say, sometimes, not all the time, but sometimes. But then, or it can be experienced, as you said, suddenly because something happens. But then also my question is, it really interests me, how? I'm not asking exactly the how, but I mean, but I would say it like that, and then I will change the phrase maybe. How do you get to be into this direct experience? Of course, the mind comes and says, all these stories, and it kind of cuts you off from that. But I guess the practice that you're doing here is also kind of bringing you closer to direct experience of who I am, my being here. But anyway, I just, this phrase, direct experience, did something to me, just really, and I need to know it a little more.
Yeah, good question, and that's everybody's question, actually. Everyone's wondering, how can I do that? And exactly, as you say, this Zen practice is how we say, you know, that, like when I open up the husk of the corn, you know, it's a complete accident, that moment, right? Yes. Those moments like that, when everything falls away, complete accident. That's the way we think of it, right? And we say that this practice of sitting, just sitting down, moment after moment, just dropping, not involving with the thoughts, just letting it go, letting it go, letting it go. You say that's cultivating the ground so that accidents will happen. Mm. That sounds nice. You know, it sounds like a cute formula. It didn't come from me. I'm not the one who invented that. It was my Zumi Roshi who said that phrase. But the truth is that artists have their ways of doing it. You know, they... there's a French poet I like, and he says, and I feel the same way, I write and then after I see. So I do it and then I see after what it is. Mm-hmm. If I'm in this thing of this is what I'm going to write, then it's not it. Mm-hmm. Right? And you know that. Mm-hmm. And you know that in music too.
Yeah.
So how do we then enter that, as you say? How do we cultivate that? Our way in the Zen practice is to just sit, and then stand up and carry that into our lives and make everything that helps us to see the oneness instead of the separation. To like look between, see the space between things instead of focusing on the objects or the people. To see everything as sacred. This was, you know, that why I love James Joyce's books so much, because he made everything sacred instead of saying only certain things are sacred, everything is sacred, which is our Zen practice too. And then that helps us to let go of an idea of what is good and what is bad, and helps us to then experience it just as it is without our ideas about how it should be, or what, if it's good or bad or something, if it's sacred or not. I love that phrase too from an American Supreme Court justice, who I don't remember which one, but there was a case of, I don't know, you know, maybe it was Allen Ginsberg, maybe it was Henry Miller, maybe it was it wasn't Joyce. Anyway, there was something presented, or maybe it was even like the movie Deep Throat or something. It was something that was being considered obscene and could not be, was therefore going to be outlawed. And so the Supreme Court justice said, I can't give you a definition of obscenity, but I know it when I see it. And this is his way of saying what we're saying, you know. I can't define it, you know. It depends. And the more that we can let go of those definitions, of our even like walking down the street definitions. So I walk here today, I'm so used to walking down this boulevard, the Faubourg Saint-Antoine. I used to live just in the Rue de Chahan, just up the street. You know, I've been coming here for 40 years. We came here for a while because we set a sitting practice here. So I'm walking down the street and I'm looking at all these stores and thinking, oh, that one didn't used to be there. Oh, something else used to be there. Oh, you know, those must be American tourists at Starbucks and, you know, like all this stuff. Instead of just walking down the street and experiencing the street, you know, just experiencing the moment. Or one time when we came here with the Belgian guy, Daniel, I came with him from Montreuil. We came up out of the metro from the opera stop. So we came up from underground. You walk up those steps from the opera, and it was a beautiful day like this, and there was, you know, there's the Bastille, the Génie de la Bastille, that's like rising there in the middle. And he was just like stunned. It was kind of like me with the caterpillar on him. And just like stunned by this. And he just looked at me and he said, wow, something about this was not made for humans or something. He was experiencing it like beyond the concept of the Bastille column, the genie at the top. How, you know, that genie at the top is like actually 2 meters high or something. We look at it and it looks like it's this tiny little thing, but it's actually really tall. And just the whole thing, he actually said that this was not made for humans or something. Because his experience of it was non-conceptual, something like that. Mm-hmm. So it's about freeing ourselves, letting go, remembering to come back. Something like that. So I'm looking at the screen too, and Adrien actually has a scarf on. I'm like, is it cold there? We're hot here. So it's like, yeah. So, just different. So then I immediately, scarf, must be hot. Probably has nothing to do with the heat. It must be cold. Who knows, you know? completely. You see where our mind goes. But that's the essential question, so and that's what we're doing. And so we ask, who am I? And let go of whatever comes up about it. Who am I? I don't know. Who am I? I'm this, I'm that. Drop it. Who am I? I don't know. This or that. I'm that. I don't know. And then at some point, you might have this moment, which, you know, comes to my Dharma name, which is Tue Sala. You are that. You're looking for something else, but you're it. This is it. That which is before you in all its fullness. No, that which before you is it in all its fullness, utterly complete. And that was not me who invented that phrase, who wrote that phrase either. It was one part. Yeah. So, yes, Adayam.
So the genie on the bestie is actually 4 meters tall. High.
Oh, is it? Yeah, okay. I knew it was higher than we thought. Yeah,
yeah, but it's hello.
Hello.
And I am cold. As surprising as it sounds. That's it.
Perfect. Debbie, you had your hand up.
Yeah, I was thinking when you were talking, Lisa, I'm not preparing for my mother's death. I'm preparing in the beginning I was preparing in a logical, legal way for my own death. And I got to get a notaire on what are the things you do and everything. And I kind of gave up on that for the moment because I don't understand when I talk to them. I don't know what they're talking about. So I thought, well, let's do it on another level. I have notebooks from when I was 8 in my, they all are at my house now. I've kept a diary off and on for the last 100 years. It's about, and I thought, you know what's going to happen? I'm going to die, and they're going to come in here, and somebody says, oh, look, let's read this. I'm like, no, we're not going to do that. So I've been rereading them, first of all, which is a kick. Some of them, you know, sort of goes from to move, but some of them I actually talk about what's going on instead of talking about myself. So, and read them, see what's in there, and then the first one I thought, oh, I'll just keep this one. I said, no, Debbie, let's not start that way. So I toss them after I read them. I put them in the trash. It is the most wonderful experience. So I don't, well, I say that. It just, it makes me feel very joyful or something. And in the process, like this t-shirt that I, all of a sudden, I'm trying to get rid of it. I have clothes coming out of my clothes. I wash all my clothes by hand. So they last for fucking ever. I have clothes I've had for 30 years. They look new. So, and I don't wear them. And they're stacked up. So I started thinking, this is not good here. Let's see who needs what. And going through all these clothes, I find things that really, woman upstairs, I have this very classy dress. It would look ridiculous on me. But the woman upstairs has a daughter who is very classy and tall and long-legged and stuff. So it's starting to become, it's like a game, you know. So that, Lisa, that I spent the whole week saying, I've got the right present. So get rid of things, and then we'll see about the notaire, because nobody, my brother doesn't really speak French, and he's already said, I don't want to deal with French legal stuff. So that's the end of that. But he might want to deal with my notebooks. So we're dumping the notebooks, get rid of all these clothes that I'm never, not all of them, but a lot of clothes that I won't wear. And it's, I don't know, it's such a, it's fun. Well, first of all, I needed something to do this year because I took the year off to write. I've written about 2 pages since I started that process. So I got to rethink that one. So I was getting really bored. And I thought, oh, I know what we can do. Let's get this out of here. So depending on, it's harder when it's somebody else, I think. I was much more mourning about my parents
for the moment, first of all, I don't really believe I'm going to die. Like most people. Yeah. I'll leave that to y'all. But, so it's going to be like a fun pretend thing that I'm doing. I'm just thinking of that when you're talking about it. No.
I just want to recognize, well, thank you for the talk. It's really interesting that we're talking about death, because this is a year to the day that Magali died. My dear friend, my French sister, I still think about it. And it's been, it's been a big year for me, adjusting to that, but also realizing really, I mean, my father died when I was 35, my mother died over, like, 15 years ago now. So I don't deal with the things of older parents. So Magali is really the first person as an aging adult, that I've had to deal with death. And it's been a wonderful, actually, I can really say that today, it's been a really wonderful experience. Horrible in many ways. I mean, it's like this ultimate separation, death. And yet I'm realizing more and more and more that it's almost like the ultimate connection. Because she's not here physically, she's everywhere. And I just invited her to be with us this morning, and it was really moving. It was really simple. I mean, it wasn't a grandiose thing. It was just really simple, and it seemed so organic and right. And it's this practice that has brought me to do this. And that was my answer to your question. I mean, I'm not the teacher here. But my answer for me was like, but yeah, I would just, it's just what is. So that experience is just like, whatever is. I don't know, I mean, that seems so weird. But it's so true for me more and more and more. Whatever it is. And here I am too, and this is it, I am it. Again, words very quickly dissolve the meaning of it for me. I have a difficult time putting into words, as you all know who know me. But I just wanted to share that with you, because this practice has been, it is really, without saying it in a, without meaning to anything grandiose or small, it's just, it is what I realize my life is. So thank you. And thanks to Magali, because everything I've learned, thanks to her.
So, as we say, life and death are of supreme importance.
Yeah.
Time swiftly passes by. And opportunity is lost. Awaken. Don't squander your life. Yeah, I mean, like John Lennon said, life is what happens when we're planning for other things. So, do we really want to waste our time planning for other stuff? You know, do we really want to do that?
I just realized really recently how I'm like, that's so true. And then I realized I'm thinking, well, say, so I'll do that. I'll go do that. But wait, no, it's right now, you know, it's like, it's not like when I finish sitting or whatever, I mean, this is it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, while we're on the subject, whatever the subject is, thank you, Roshi, for the beginning discussion about this term emptiness, which I tried to talk to, well, I didn't try, Joa and I have discussed it too. It got me so confused in the beginning. I would, before I started practicing here or really anywhere, but I was sitting and reading books and stuff, that I think, well, emptiness, if you have a bowl of fruit and there's no fruit in it and it's empty, but what about the bowl? And I get myself all tangled up in this. And in fact, I think it's just a vocabulary question, really. East-West thing or something. So I really thank you for putting the dots on the I's.
Yeah, because it's, you know, language belongs to the discursive mind, and so, you know, if it's empty, then it's not full.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And
but not full of what?
Right. So then there's that. Okay. So then it's empty of something, and of a thing. And in fact, it's not empty in the way that we think it's empty. We just use that word because we need to put some word on it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's actually, we could say fullness. In fact, could say fullness instead of emptiness.
Yeah, we have discussed this with you before.
Yeah.
There's a song by Leonard Cohen. I think I talked about this. Where he says that it's like we go through life like like dragging a suitcase through the night. Some people say it's empty, but it doesn't mean it's light.
Ooh, pretty.
Yeah.
What song is that?
A street. A street, I think.
And at the same time, you know, Kundera, the unbearable lightness of being. Right? It's so light that it's unbearable for our ego, what we call the ego. Okay, it looks like it is 1:20. Maybe we should stop there for lunch here. And I guess you there, whatever you're going to do for yourselves. So we'll be back at... It's 2:30, is that okay for us, do you think, here?
Mm-hmm.
Is that enough time, or should we take more? 2:45?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. 2:45, Miguel, that's 1:45 for you, if you're coming back, I don't know, but...
I can't sit, sorry.
Okay. So, whoever comes back, we'll see you this afternoon, or not, and... Okay.
I won't be back. So bon appétit, everyone. Take care. Good to see you all.
See. So.
Bye.